my sort of sense of social media, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and stuff, is that the norm is kind of the equivalent of digital road rage. I mean, everyone is looking for something to be angry and upset about, and where they're not upset and angry and where they're supportive, that seems to kind of go against that kind of norm. And that's a really unhealthy way of engaging in thoughtful reflection, engaging in scholarship and trying to create something that will have a lasting impact. But Twitter is like having a very, very short a conversation that in some sense really does kind of get lost in the shuffle. And you want things that people can teach from. You want things that people can look to and see as markers of moments in time, markers of thought, markers of ways of engaging deeply with ideas. It's just so hard to do in whatever the number of characters are now.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome back. We're glad to have with us today Joshua Kim and Eddie Maloney talking about their new book, Learning Innovation and the Future of Higher Education. If you didn't catch last week's episode, go back and listen to it now. Welcome back, guys.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Brad. It's great to be back.
When you talk about centers for teaching and learning, one of the observations you make is that they need to evolve more closely to resemble academic departments. What would that look like?
Every time I talk to my folks or anyone else about looking like an academic department, you know, there's some concern about that because academic departments are not always as functional as we would like them to be. Some are better than others. Some are more tense than others. And some are quite wonderful places to be. But less so than an academic department and more what we've now started to think about as an interdisciplinary field where we think there are a set of expertise, there's a set of scholarship, there's a set of skills that are coming together that form the kind of contours of what we see happening in higher education, whether that's through an understanding of technology and innovation or design, particularly learning design, but other all types of design. Certainly the role that analytics is playing and a kind of critical perspective on higher education, that kind of combination of disciplines that come together in this interdisciplinary space needs some attention, and it needs the type of attention that an academic department or at least some coalition of academics and scholars could bring to it. We like to think about that as from a practitioner's perspective, not simply from a scholarly perspective. And so that it has to involve scholarship, but it also it has to involve practice. One of the phrases that we use here in Candles a lot is applied innovation, so that practice of innovation is in application. And it also, from my perspective, and I think Josh shares this, it needs to involve helping to train the next generation of folks who are coming along to do this work. And we've started to do that at Georgetown. We created a graduate program 3 years ago in learning design and technology that is specific to those skills and expertise within higher education. It brings a kind of critical analysis, critical perspective on higher education into the conversation and into the context in which that work is happening. So we look at it from that perspective, the work of teaching, the work of scholarship and research, and the work of service, or in our context, applied innovation, all come together. And those are the three areas that often define the kind of contours of an academic department.
Excellent.
Josh, did I miss anything there? We talk about this all the time, so it's sometimes there are pieces that we forget or I forget.
Yeah, and it's difficult to, you know, to kind of talk about, you know, your own place, but it really should be said that what Eddie is doing at Georgetown is really, you know, is leading our field. Georgetown was very early to develop an integrated center for teaching and learning that combined kind of the traditional educational developer and the instructional designers. And we've seen that happen a lot with a lot of mergers. And now as Georgetown really moves into leading in scholarship and teaching and integrating all this into one place, I think it's a model that we'll see in other places. Certainly at Dartmouth, we have a smaller teaching and learning center called DECAL, the Center for the Advancement of Learning, which is kind of a more traditional center for teaching and learning, but we're starting to take on more aspects of an integrated center, having leadership for online learning on campus. And you know, I really hope we move into this idea that we'll also be teaching and be scholars within these units that we're in.
As you both described this, it makes me appreciate the very unique place we are right now in the history of higher ed, really at a location where some amazing things can happen and are happening across the academy.
Yeah, it is very exciting. I think, and that's that kind of turn to learning that we're trying to mark. And for many, when we say that phrase, they say, well, we've been doing this, you know, this is our history, this is our context. I think Josh shares this view with me. I don't think that that is how all of higher ed has seen itself. And the fact that we've now kind of, or at least for a period of time, we had this shared attention on this problem, I think is really impressive. And it's exciting. It's allowed for some really interesting things to happen. And hopefully, at least our hope is that that will continue. So the other reason why we wrote this book is not just to mark that turn to learning, but to figure out how we can continue to encourage that to be part of the center of the conversations that are happening in higher education.
Very good. One of the other observations you make is that the growth of online education has also had an improvement factor on residential campuses. How do you see that happening?
Yeah, this is one of the key points we try to make in the book, in that, and as part of what we see as the turn to learning, is this growth of online education. And as online education was growing, you know, it wasn't really expected that one of the results would be to improve residential education. Schools invested in online education to serve markets and serve their students and to, you know, bring in revenues and all these sorts of reasons that they did. But it had this kind of unexpected consequence of really raising the bar for face-to-face and residential education. And the reason for that is that schools brought in all these instructional designers and all these experts in media and all these experts in assessment. You know, you really need to have a team approach of faculty and instructional designers and other folks to develop a really high-quality online course or online program, but you Absolutely. Can use the exact same methodology in residential face-to-face blended courses. And we see that happening all over. So, you know, this is one of the factors that we see in this turn to learning that we try to mark.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's also a place where you can start to see the things that are that may be less visible in how you teach in a face-to-face space. One of the kind of common examples is that in an online environment, it's much harder to hide. It's much harder to kind of sit in the back row. It's much harder to be invisible when you have to always contribute in some way, whether that's through writing or through a particular kind of engagement. In a lot of face-to-face classes, you can kind of avoid that glare or that perspective. And just to note that, as a teacher who might move between modalities, will encourage you in your face-to-face classes to think about other ways to bring students into that conversation that you might have just simply let lie. And that's, you know, I think that's pretty exciting.
That is a great outcome, and one I frankly had not thought about. You also have kind of a critical look at social media, blogs, Twitter, etc., and the role they're playing in the conversations about learning innovation. What are your concerns about that?
Well, that's only because Josh writes a blog, and so we just wanted to be entirely critical of him. So. I don't know, Josh, do you want to take this one?
Sure, I can start, but you definitely have strong opinions, which I appreciate. So we make an argument in the book that social media is great. Like, you know, blogs and Twitter, they're really good for fast reactions and building some types of community and for exchange, for rapid exchange of ideas. We have nothing against social media. We participate in social media ourselves through the writing that Eddie and I do for Inside Higher Ed and other kinds of things. So we're all for that. We just think that it's become unbalanced. We think that the kind of work for institution-led learning innovation deserves more space, more consideration, more nuance. It needs to find a foundation that is more solid, that, you know, people can go back and look at what's been done. So we think that we need to bring some balance back by also having some peer-reviewed scholarship in articles and book chapters and books. So we think they can live both together. We hope so.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also my sort of sense of social media, particularly the more kind of reactionary spaces like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and stuff, is that the norm is kind of the equivalent of digital road rage. I mean, everyone is looking for something to be angry and upset about, and where they're not upset and angry and where they're supportive, and that seems to kind of go against that kind of norm. I mean, that's a really unhealthy way of engaging in thoughtful reflection, engaging in scholarship, and trying to create something that will have a lasting impact. But Twitter is like having a very, very short a conversation that, in some sense, you know, despite all of our examples of where Twitter never goes away, really does kind of get lost in the shuffle. And you want things that people can teach from. You want things that people can look to and see as markers of moments in time, markers of thought, markers of ways of engaging deeply with ideas. That is, it's just so hard to do in whatever the number of characters are now, 200 and something characters, I don't even know.
So is it possible, if you were selective about the people that you follow on Twitter, for example, that you could have a conversation like, hey, I had this idea last night. What do you think of this? And cross all boundaries, begin to share those kinds of random thoughts that may lead to something bigger later, but kind of use Twitter in that capacity rather than just road rage or other types of things like that.
I think that happens now among many of our colleagues. Twitter has really become the primary way that folks stay connected and share ideas. That's terrific. I think it's likely most people will hear about our book on Twitter, maybe in your podcast, but
more likely on Twitter.
Yeah. So, you know, that's we're all for that. We just think that there needs to be brought back some balance into this.
Yep.
And, you know, frankly, it's one of the things that we write about. It's challenging for people like us doing this work. I mean, we talked about how wonderful it was to write this book together, but the fact is we're doing this where we both have, you know, very demanding full-time jobs. Eddie's job is incredibly demanding given he runs a large center. So it was a real challenge to just sort of find the time and the space to think. And, you know, I'll speak for myself here is that, you know, at Dartmouth, I don't have tenure. So, you know, I'll say some things that people disagree with. And in writing this book, you know, we don't have the protections that traditional academics often have. So it's not
that
there's reasons why that there's been what we see as a real lack of scholarship around institution-led learning innovation and why it's gone so much to social media. So we're trying to open up a conversation to build a new discipline or interdisciplinary field. We're trying to create a space where people can actually develop these ideas and have these conversations.
So one of the other things that we talk about in the book that I think is pertinent here is that the communities that are created in Twitter can be amazing, especially for people who've not had communities in other spaces, whether that's where they work or the college or university that they happen to occupy. They may not have a very large community, and social media can really extend that. But it's also by definition, often a contained community. And
True.
So the ideas tend to get circulated more narrowly, maybe more than they would have if they were published in an article or something where people were not sharing. But it does concern me, at least, that there's form these kind of social media cliques that become the space for communication and for engagement. Some very supportive, some very thoughtful of that community, but in many respects, very limited. And that's, I think, of concern if one of your goals is to try to create a space where knowledge can be created and shared in the most successful ways. It's also the case that in my experience, which is probably more limited than many, the extent of Twitter conversations are pretty rare. When I watch a kind of Twitter thread that might be taking off, it might have 7, 10, 12 responses, and that's a big one. You know, some of these ones that have hundreds and more do, it seems to me, kind of devolve into trolling pretty quickly rather than into
True.
Anything meaningful. So in some sense, the more supportive conversations are rarer, it seems, and shorter. I'm sure everyone is going to prove me wrong in this, but it still does not seem, at least in my experience, to rise to the level of a deep and meaningful engagement, despite how important and valuable it can be. So as Josh said, I think it's about balance. It's about finding both of those spaces. And just one final point, I think a lot of the pushback that we received on some of these ideas and the book as we were talking to people were from folks who were concerned that that space, whether that was a social media space or the space that they occupy on campus that they've been able to carve out for themselves, would somehow be infringed upon by an argument for something that was more open or more engaging with a wider group of people to enter into that conversation. There's kind of, I think, a fear of either a need for particular kinds of credentials or a particular kind of position at the university in order to be part of that conversation rather than seeing it as open and as wide as possible.
So on a day-by-day basis, where do the two of you go to keep current on what people are thinking, the new developments that are coming out, even things that are in process?
I think that's a really good question, and I'll start and just kind of speak for myself. I feel like I'm at a part, at a time in my career where I've been working on online learning and learning technology for a long time. And that's been great. That's been wonderful. But at this point, I'm interested in looking more across the institution and understanding all the ways that the college here needs to change and where it's going, and then looking across the ecosystem of higher education. So I think that I'm at a point where I'm trying to use this background that I have first in sociology in my training and then in doing online learning and learning technology for a couple decades and seeing where that goes next to have influence and impact across the institution and across the ecosystem. So I find myself reading much more widely about all the forces that affect higher education, demographic, economic, political, and trying to use my learning technology brain and my learning innovation brain to try to have it, you know, be part of those larger conversations.
Very good.
And if you've ever read Josh's column in Inside Higher Ed, you'll see that he's bringing in an incredibly impressive amount of different kinds of disciplinary engagements and trying to bring them to bear on higher ed. It's really impressive. I think it's also the answer to the question for me is that it's hard. It's hard to continue to find those spaces where that deep work is happening. There's a lot of good journalism in higher education that's happening where you can read about really good things in Inside Higher Ed and in the Chronicle and EdSurge and so on.
True.
There are some really thoughtful people who are on social media who are posting ideas and I'm sharing some of their work. Hopefully, at least the ones that I tend to find more interesting or go beyond, you know, what can happen in a tweet or two. And, you know, you go to conferences and you hear about work that's happening there as well. So the communities start to grow and form in different kinds of ways where you hear about good work.
So as we think about this book coming out in February, the answer to the question, who should read it? The answer, of course, is everybody. But if we were to narrow that down a little bit, are there particular groups of people in higher ed that you think should pay attention to this conversation?
So I think you can start to categorize folks, people who are doing this work on the ground in Centers for Teaching Excellence, Centers for Technology and Innovation, and so on, who care about this work and are looking for, you know, some folks who are trying to think about this and start a conversation. We certainly hope that people who are in senior leadership positions who are trying to think about what conversation is happening around learning and learning innovation in the world that they should be paying attention to, what that looks like and how they should be thinking about that, we'll read the book as well. For us, we wrote this book not to be definitive in any sense. We didn't write this book to make a particular argument that said, this is how we want everyone to think about learning innovation. We really wrote this book to open up a conversation about learning innovation, about higher education, where higher education is going, and how we can contribute to that direction. So in some sense, anyone that I would identify as someone who could or should read this book would be someone who wants to be part of that conversation. You know, this is just a start to it, hopefully not in any way meant to put a period on it.
Very good.
And I would just add to what Eddie talked about, you know, we also think about who are the people who are going to do this work behind us, who's going to come up and do this work. Neither Eddie or I trained or went to graduate school to do work in learning innovation leadership. We come at this from other ways.
Right.
So Eddie and Georgetown and his center, as he talked about, started a new program to train students in learning design and technology. And, you know, we think a lot about, okay, this will be the next generation of people who are actually training to do this work, to lead colleges and universities to align teaching methods with learning science, which has not always been the case. So, and to do that, you need to know a lot. You need to know a lot about learning science and instructional design methods. You have to know how universities work and how they change and how budgets work and the political and demographic forces. You need to know about analytics and you need to know about design. There's all sorts of things that you have to know to do the really hard work of advancing learning at our institutions.
That's exciting that you've given thought to that next generation of innovators and learning scientists. So very important.
It's amazing to have, we now have had three cohorts of students enter into the program and some continue in the program. It's really fascinating not only to watch where they're coming from, what their passions are, what their interests are, but how they really engage with this question about where higher education is going and how they feel like they can contribute to that problem.
What are some of the factors that have led them to be so excited about this area of learning?
It varies so much. When we started the program, as you do when you're starting a new graduate program or any type of program, I assume, is you do market research, try to figure out, you know, who your feeder programs are going to, or what your feeder programs are going to be, and what your students are going to be. And our students have come from everywhere, all over the world, all over the country, in different areas, all different kinds of schools, different kinds of backgrounds. They all have a particular kind of passion, I would say first for teaching and learning, but for this idea that they want to contribute to a conversation about learning. They want to contribute to helping people understand how to learn better. And then many of them, the kind of second piece is about higher education. For many of them, they want to continue to be part of higher ed. So we have a lot of folks who are actually working in higher ed now and want to figure out how to stay relevant in higher education, how to contribute to the conversations that are happening on their campuses. And sometimes that's happening at colleges and universities in the United States. But we have many students who are coming from, you know, different parts of the world and want to contribute to the kinds of conversations that are happening about higher ed there back at home.
Very exciting. Well, I'm going to ask the question that I'm sure our audience has been waiting for, and that is, will there be a Learning Innovation in the Future of Higher Education, Volume 2? Too soon to ask that question?
The process for writing this book was actually really enjoyable and difficult for the reasons we laid out, that, you know, you have to fit this in with everything else and there's lots going on and we're talking about difficult things. But, you know, what I think is that in my academic career going forward, I'm 50 now, so the next however many years, I plan that scholarship and hopefully teaching will be a large part of this. And that's been a challenge, having a non-traditional academic career. I also plan to do all this work with Eddie, that actually having a research partner that you actually develop every idea with and argue a great deal has been so invigorating that, you know, it's so sure there's going to be more books in the future.
Excellent. Glad to hear that. So for those of you who are tuning in, and we know there are a cast of thousands at this moment listening to this podcast, we encourage you to take advantage of this new book, Learning Innovation and the Future of Higher Ed, which will come out in February. And I want to thank Josh and Eddie for being with us today and sharing some of their amazing insights. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Brad. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, great discussion, Brad. Thank you.
We'll talk again soon. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Have a great day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.